Jesse Stewart is an award-winning percussionist, scholar, composer, artist, writer, instrument maker, and community activist. In 2012, he founded We Are All Musicians, founded on his belief that music is a fundamental human right, through which he helps create opportunities for people to make music, regardless of age, musical training, socioeconomic circumstance, and ability. During the conversation, he demonstrates how any object can be used to create interesting music, and we also get to hear him improvise on a waterphone, as well as with me on my violin, with a unique instrument which he explains. I do hope you'll find Jesse to be as inspiring and interesting as I do. I've included timestamps in the description for both the video and podcast format. The video is closed captioned, and the transcript will be published soon at the same link on my podcast website. Hi, Jesse Stewart.
Hi, Leah. Nice to see you.
Nice to see you again. I wanted to thank you because I did that little improvisation online workshop with you and Ellen Waterman, who was on season one of this podcast last year. And it was really transformative. Like, it really just, the simple ideas that just helped give us a sense of play. And we were all classical musicians in this workshop. It was really amazing. And since then, I have continued an improvisation practice.
Oh, that's wonderful. Well, I certainly enjoyed our time together as well. So, but that's wonderful to hear that you've continued. That's great.
So to introduce you to people that don't know you, I was thinking, okay, like, you're a composer, multi-instrumentalist, community activist, visual artist. I'm sure I've missed a few things. Educator, author.
Well, I think you've covered the bases there.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's true that I play multiple instruments, but for the most part, it's mainly percussion. You know, I started off on drum set, and I play a variety of percussion instruments, but that's really my home base, I would say.
But would you say that all percussionists are multi-instrumentalists and not necessarily struck instruments, right?
Yeah, I think that that's true. Part of me thinks that percussionists are all secretly like collectors, because almost every percussionist I know has, you know, quite a number of different instruments, you know, in their basement or in their workshop or what have you. I think that's true. Percussionists are often called upon to play a wide variety of instruments. And even something like the drum set, which I still sort of consider my home base. That's what I started out playing, was drum set when I was young. Even it is a combination of multiple instruments, of course, right, from different musical and cultural traditions. So you have the bass drum and the snare drum from the European kind of, you know, marching band tradition, and we have Turkish cymbals, and originally the tom-tom in a drum set was a Chinese tom-tom. So it's interesting that we have all these different, you know, different percussion instruments from various traditions that were kind of all brought together and you know, a little more than 100 years ago or something, and people found a way to play them together. So the new things were a foot pedal that allowed people to play the bass drum with their foot, and then also a foot operated pair of cymbals, which eventually became the hi-hat cymbals. Mm-hmm. So percussionists, I think, often, you're right, they typically play multiple instruments. Yeah.
And the waterphone, which I heard you play before, I mean, that's a bowed instrument primarily.
That's true. Yeah, in fact, I have one here.
Ooh.
So if people want to see it, and I could even play it if you like. So this is a waterphone. It consists of bronze rods that have been welded to this stainless steel. It's almost like two stainless steel trays, and then there's this central kind of cylinder, which is hollow. And it's typically played with water inside of it. So I don't know if you can hear this, but can you hear the water sloshing?
Yes.
Yeah. So. And then, this is a very odd coincidence, but the man who invented the instrument, his name was Richard Waters.
And I was going to mention that, yeah.
Yeah. So between the water inside the instrument and his name being Richard Waters, he called it the Waterphone. And he, in fact, made this one for me. He made four Waterphones for me of different sizes. This is the biggest one. He called this the Mega Bass Waterphone. And it's probably my favorite. I find it the most expressive. But you're right that it can be played in many different ways. But typically, it's most often bowed, and so we can bow one of these bronze rods. Now I'm going to bow it again, and this time I'm going to tilt the instrument a little bit, and you'll hear the water move across the bottom resonating plate, which kind of shapes the sound in an interesting way. Here we go. Often you'll hear this in movie soundtracks. Yeah, so you get the idea. But of course, I play it in all kinds of ways. Sometimes I'll play it with my hands. I'll sometimes play it with mallets. Sometimes I'll use other kinds of mallets. Like this is Richard Waters actually made this for me. It's just a piece of bamboo that he sort of carved down, so it's quite flexible. And then there's a rubber ball, a super ball on the end. But if you drag that across the bottom resonating plate, or you could play there too, get these sort of whale-like sounds. So, yeah, that's the Waterphone.
You know, that brings to mind a few things. A couple of your projects, the one I really love, I think it's called Pulse, when you filmed the dripping of the water on the drum head.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I've done that a few times. Yeah. And, so I've done that with just a single drum. And it was a drum that I had specially made out of clear acrylic, so the drum is sort of transparent. And then... and the head is clear, the drum head is clear. And then I actually, what you probably couldn't tell is that I actually used silicone to kind of caulk the head so that water wouldn't seep inside the drum. Mm-hmm. And then I had a IV bag positioned above it and, experimented with different drip rates and then eventually just opened the stopcock on the IV bag all the way so that the water just pooled on the head and then, played it in the... the water kind of danced and sprayed. So I've done that with, so I think the video you've seen is just a snare drum. I've done an installation along those lines where it was a full drum set, and on every drum I had an IV bag positioned over, and they were all dripping at different rates. And that was set up at a Nuit Blanche event, and so they dripped all night. And I'd sort of worked out in advance the drip rate to sort of essentially, I wanted in the morning that the bags to be very close to empty so that I'd have a pool of water. And so I think at 5 a.m. I did a performance on all these water-covered drums and got everybody wet. So, yeah, but at any rate, yeah. I've used water quite a bit, as it turns out, in my work. I've also done some things with ice as well.
I was going to bring that up as well. But I have to say, like, it's so evocative. I think I've seen two videos of you doing, the drip thing. And at first I was like, what is he doing? How is he, making this happen? And then, I think you can see it at a certain point or at the end. Oh. But it's very evocative. It's just amazingly powerful. And it joins your interest in, you're a visual artist as well. Would you say that it's at that intersection?
Yeah, very much so. I majored in both visual art and in music as an undergrad student, and I found that the visual arts and sonic arts I sort of illuminated one another for me in interesting and productive ways, and And I also found that a lot of my teachers on the visual arts side were really incredibly supportive of, you know, some of the things that I was interested in musically. Maybe more so than some of the teachers on the music side, you know, who were less interested in, let's say, experimental music than they were, you know, classical music and other things. But on the visual arts side, I had a number of teachers that were really supportive and engaged. So that includes a sculptor named Reinhard Reichenstein, with whom I'm still friends. And he introduced me to his partner, Gail Young, who is an instrument inventor and builder, and is incredibly knowledgeable about experimental music, contemporary music. And so, while I was still a student, you know, I was very fortunate to meet both of them. And actually, I think maybe the very first recording I ever made was with Gail and with Reinhard, and also with Jacques Israelovich, whom you may know of. He was the former concertmaster of the Toronto Symphony Orchestra. And we did some performances together as a quartet, and that was recorded and released. I think that was the first commercially released recording I made. Actually, I was still a student at the time, but at any rate, Reinhard was very supportive. Also, I studied with a photographer and performance artist named Susie Lake, who was also tremendously supportive of my interest in music and very knowledgeable about, you know, contemporary music, experimental music. So I found that there was a lot of support there, but certainly I would say that background, my dual background in music and composition, but then also in visual art. And in visual art, I studied sculpture, but also I got increasingly interested in what many people describe as sound art, but also media-based art, installation art, and performance art, actually. So those were those. I think that a piece like the one that you're mentioning, with the water, is it's somewhere in between music and performance art, I think. You know, I've tried to make a career out of, making work that sort of straddles some of those disciplinary boundaries, I guess, or explores the spaces between them.
Yeah. And back when you were a teenager and you were really into jazz, you built a vibraphone in order to play a tune by Chick Corea, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. I did, actually. That was one of the first, I guess it wasn't the first, but one of the first instruments that I built. And that was because at my high school, the music department, their vibraphone was broken. And so I really loved that a duo record that Chick Corea and Gary Burton made called Crystal Silence, and that tune Crystal Silence I thought was so beautiful, and I thought, I'd love to learn this on vibes, which I didn't know. I had never played piano or anything, you know. So I thought, how am I going to do this? I don't have access to a vibraphone. So I ended up in my grandfather's wood shop. I made a vibraphone, and actually I wish I still had it, actually, because I made a dampener pedal out of well, it was like a TV tray kind of thing. That was the pedal, and I hooked up springs to it, and so that I could dampen the bars. And anyways, it actually worked okay. So I used that. But making the frame out of wood wasn't the best decision, because it didn't hold up very well in the long run. But at any rate, yeah, that was one of the. It wasn't the first instrument I made, but it was more complicated than any other instrument that I had made to that point, you know. And it was a useful experience, even though, as I say, it didn't survive very long. It allowed me to learn that tune and start thinking about pitch getting a little bit, a tiny bit of familiarity with mallet percussion, which has never been a major focus for me, you know. But just start thinking melodically. That was useful at that time for me. But also, you know, just realizing, I can build a vibraphone, you know. So that was kind of encouraging as well. And certainly during, you know, as an undergraduate student and then beyond, I made lots of instruments out of all kinds of different things. So that those experiences, early experiences with instrument building, it was time well spent, I think. I learned from those things.
So your project Glacialis, which is the ice, like you had it in Ottawa. I think you're commissioned to do it for Winterlude.
Yeah.
Then you brought it to Toronto.
Yeah.
To transport.
Yeah. That was a very funny thing how that came about. That would have been, I guess, in 2009. A friend of mine named Rich Marcella, he's now the executive director of the Regent Park School of Music in Toronto. So he does a lot in the area of community music and is just a real force, you know, a force for good in the world. At that time, Rich did a one-year contract for the NCC in Ottawa. So he relocated to Ottawa for 1 year. And so he invited me to do a bunch of stuff on Canada Day that year. At that time, the NCC is the National Capital Commission, and in Ottawa, Canada's capital. And anyways, at that time, they programmed all of the festivities for Canada Day as well as Winterlude. So anyways, he got me to do some stuff on Canada Day. I used a bunch of recycled materials to make a kind of interactive, I called it the Junk Funk Sound Cube or something. So it was all like recycled materials that kids could, you know, play on, you know. And that was a lot of fun. And anyways, at the end of the day, you know, we sat down and I said, you know, congratulations. I mean, this you know, I know this was a lot of work to pull this off. And he said, yeah. I said, thanks. He said, but you know, I've got to start planning for Winterlude like immediately. And I just floated the idea. I said, you know, it'd be kind of cool. It'd be to have like ice music at Winterlude. And he said, you know what? That sounds great. You're hired. You do it. And that was how that project, I didn't even know if it was possible to make music with ice at that point. I later learned that there are other people who do that. I didn't know about their work yet. There's a fellow, he's in one of the Scandinavian countries, Terje Eisenset, I think is his name, and I'm not sure, maybe he may be Norwegian, I'm not sure about that. But I didn't know, I had never heard his work, I didn't know about him. And so I thought, I hope this works out okay, you know. But that was how that came about. And anyway, so I started experimenting with things and developed some, you know, some marimba type instruments out of ice. But I made some other things. There's a type of drum called an udu drum that's typically made out of clay, and I made one. I made a few out of ice and other things, you know. Wrote music for those things. And then the way it went to Toronto was similarly bizarre. I was playing not in Toronto, but at a festival in London, Ontario. A festival which stopped a long time ago. It was called London Ontario Live Arts. And they were screening a video work of mine, and I was also playing music there with Michael Snow, actually. Michael Snow, who's a well-known visual artist and filmmaker, and also improvising pianist. And Michael had an exhibition in town, and I really wanted to see it. So I got a ride with somebody I didn't know. And anyways, she was asking me, she said, so what are you working on these days? She was sort of asking me, like, what do you do? You know, what projects are you working on? And I said, well, you know, I'm starting working on this ice music project. And she said, oh, really? She said, oh, that sounds very interesting. And so anyways, it turned out that she worked for the city of Toronto, which at that time had a winter festival. I think it was called Winter City. And so she said, you know what, can we also commission you? Can it be a joint commission between the NCC and the City of Toronto for this ice music thing? And so I ended up performing it at Nathan Phillips Square in Toronto as well. But the two, like, both of them were like total kind of happenstance. That's how that came about. It was really remarkable. And in Toronto, it was at Nathan Phillips Square outside. And we performed it a few times there. And then what was nice about that was they took a live feed of the ice music that we played, and they broadcast it in the outdoor skating rink at Nathan Phillips Square. So people were skating to the sound of their soundtrack of ice music being performed, you know, live. So that was kind of cool. And then I think that was first, and then a week or so later, we performed it in Ottawa at Winterlude. But that was a really fun project. I'd love to give a shout out to the to the my co-performers on that one, one of whom was my wife, Michelle McMillan, who's wonderful to go along with these crazy projects of mine, and also at that time, two Carleton music students joined me, one of whom was named Jamie Holmes, who's a wonderful drummer, and now, you know, I think he's on tour with J.W. Jones right now, doing a Cross Canada tour. He's a really exceptional musician. He was an exceptional musician then, he still is. He sounds really great. Wonderful drummer. And also another wonderful musician named Fraser Holmes. And Fraser was a wonderful musician, wonderful person, one of the funniest people I've ever met. And anyways, drums weren't his main instrument. Percussion wasn't his main instrument. He was a guitarist, a wonderful guitarist and singer-songwriter. But he was also quite a good drummer. And anyway, so we had a lot of fun together. And Fraser passed several years ago now. He had leukemia, but he was a wonderful, wonderful guy. But I did want to mention him. I think about him very often and think about our time together and that project in particular. I have very fond memories.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And with some of your students over the years, you've created music from boxes. Like you've shown the world that anything is viable for music, right? Any object, pretty much.
Well, that's sort of my philosophy of music making. And I did teach for a number of years. I taught an instrumentation class at Carleton, instrumentation and orchestration. So we focused primarily, I mean, for the most part, it was a kind of traditional approach to instrumentation and orchestration. We used like the Samuel Adler textbook that everybody's used for, you know, whatever, 50 years or something, you know. But I one of the points that I wanted to make in that class was, you know, look, yes, we should study that and know how to, you know, write music and, you know, for the instruments in the, you know, Western Symphony Orchestra, but it's a very big world of sound. So in addition to focusing on that stuff, there were two other components to that course, one of which was I asked all the students to research and do a presentation about another instrument that doesn't come from the Western art music tradition. So that could be an experimental instrument, it could be an instrument from a non-Western musical and cultural tradition. And so a lot of students would write about and do a presentation about instruments from their own cultural background, which was wonderful. And I said, and listen, I want everybody to develop a handout, but a fairly detailed handout that, you know, what's the range of this instrument? How do you write for it? What are, what are sort of common practice techniques? Well, what are some extended techniques? All of this kind of thing. And so I did that for a number of years, and I kept all of those handouts. And so eventually that became like kind of like a second textbook in the course that people could refer to if they were, you know, wanted to work with a daxophone, which is a little known experimental musical instrument invented by a German fellow named Hans Reichel, or, a fuhara, a Slovakian shepherd's flute or something, both of which we actually had information on those in that sort of complimentary textbook. The other part of that course was a group project that asked the students in the class to come up with an ensemble that would include every member of the class, but would take a kind of innovative approach to instrumentation, right? If we accept the idea, as I do, that really we're living in an era when any sound can be a viable sonic resource in our creative practice as composers and performers, if we accept that idea, I mean, what is that, you know, what are the implications of that for instrumentation and orchestration? So think outside the box, come up with an ensemble. And so the responses, and then basically, you know, the students would all pitch ideas, and then they would collectively decide which project they wanted to pursue. And so the first year, Curtis Perry is his name, fine composer. He's now also a teacher and a photographer, still lives in Ottawa. He suggested that we explore latex balloons as musical instruments. And it so happened that I had worked with a musician just once, I think, named Judy Dunaway, whose main instrument is balloons. And in fact, she wrote her master's thesis on the history of balloon music and, experimental music, basically. So we looked at her master's thesis, we listened to her music, and we started making all kinds of instruments out of balloons and coming up with different notational methods for how do we write down balloon music, different playing techniques and so on. And anyways, before long, word got out about this, and we were on CBC twice, one of which was a national broadcast, if you can believe that. And we did a performance together, and it was packed. Because of all the CBC coverage, I mean, it was jam packed. And then we got invitations to perform at festivals. So we performed at the Jazz Festival and the Ottawa Jazz Festival and the Ottawa Folk Festival. I think we did something at the Chamber Music Festival even. And so it was a really remarkable experience because it continued long after the semester ended. You know, for another year or something, we still got quite a bit of work, and so we kept developing, new ideas for balloons as musical instruments. And also, some of those students, had never played at a music festival before, so they had that experience. What's that like? Or, going on a radio broadcast, doing a live radio broadcast on CBC, that kind of stuff. So it was actually a good learning experience. But, so in subsequent years, the students did all kinds of things. One year we made a bunch of instruments out of paper and cardboard. One year the students decided they wanted to explore water. So actually we made a lot of water instruments, or instruments that incorporated water in one capacity or another. So, yeah, I've done, did a few things like that with students at Carleton. I actually don't teach the instrumentation course anymore, but I do still, have the good fortune of collaborating with quite a number of Carleton students in various things from time to time,
Mm-hmm. And when you went to do, you did a two masters concurrently, is my understanding, both composition and ethnomusicology.
That's right. Wow, you've done your homework. Where are you finding all this information? I did do that. Yeah.
So how was the workload? I mean, that sounds huge to me.
Well, it was intense. It was a busy time. That's for sure. But I really enjoyed it a lot. And so my two composition teachers were James Tenney, who has since passed, who was a close associate of John Cage. Jim was also a really fine pianist, in addition to being an extraordinary composer. And so he had performed in Steve Reich's ensemble. He had also performed in Philip Glass's ensemble. So, I mean, I think of Jim as sort of like the missing link between, in terms of American experimental music. He had studied with Edgar Varèse, for example. So I learned a lot from him. And then the other person that I studied with on the composition side was David Mott, baritone saxophonist and composer David Mott. With whom, David is probably my closest musical colleague and collaborator on earth. David and I play together a lot. We've been playing together now for, over 20 years. But at that time, I was a student of his and really benefited from, from my studies with him as well as with Jim. So that was on the composition side. And I just really enjoyed that was a tremendous, a really wonderful period in my life. So it was busy, yes, but I was learning a ton and really enjoying that. And then I also enjoyed having, taking musicology classes, ethnomusicology classes as well. And that was time well spent. My teachers on that side included Beverly Diamond, a very important figure in ethnomusicology, in the history of ethnomusicology in Canada, but also I took courses with Rob Bowman, who's a popular musicologist. I learned a ton from Rob, so it was actually kind of nice to have that balance. And I also took some classes in visual art too at the master's level, so I think people thought it was a little strange that I was doing all these things, but I learned a lot from each of those contexts. Yeah, so you know, it was a busy time in my life, but it was a good time. I look back at that time. The other thing I should say, and I talked about, you know, my mentors, but of course we don't learn in a vacuum. So it was also wonderful to have a community of peers to learn from and with as well, and I'm still in touch with many of those folks, and in fact I teach with some of those folks. My colleagues at Carleton, William Eckerd and Anna Hufnagels, are both alumni of York University from the time that I was there too. And on the composition side, you know, I learned a lot from, you know, some of the other folks that were, you know, in my cohort, let's say. I think I was the first person actually to graduate from that, the master's program in composition, I think. So it was quite new. It was quite a new program, that MA program. But at any rate, it was a good time. And the other thing, the one thing that's funny about that, so I ended up doing these two things at the same time. And again, it was sort of like as an undergraduate student, having one foot in the visual art program and another foot in the music program and majoring in both. And I felt like they were so, it was really illuminating for me to have, you know, both kinds of experiences. I felt the same way at the graduate level, having that my experiences in the you know, ethnomusicology, musicology courses, but then also the composition classes. They reinforced one another and sometimes contradicted one another in interesting ways that were actually, you know, intellectually productive for me. But anyways, I got to the end of that, and the university gave me one degree. And I said, but look, I did all the requirements for both of these degrees. And they said, but you only paid for one. So on my transcript, it still shows I did both things. But they said, no, you get one Master of Arts degree because you only paid for one degree. So fair enough. I guess that's the way these things work. But at any rate, I don't have any regrets, really, about that. It was, as I say, it was... yeah, it was intellectually productive for me at that time, certainly.
At the beginning of the pandemic, when we were all locked down, I believe that's when you put out a bunch of videos, like that you put on Facebook, just with found instruments. Is that at that time, like the canoe paddles? I think that one went viral.
Yeah. So that's true. So like everybody, well, I should back up a little bit. So just prior to the pandemic, I actually had brain surgery. So I had a brain tumor that I found out about late in I guess that was 2019, and so I kind of just got in under the wire just before the pandemic started. I had the 4-hour brain surgery, which was successful, but I was quite sick for at least 6 months prior to that, and so I had to stop playing music. I couldn't sit up, let alone hold drumsticks or hold an instrument. I got pretty weak there for a while. So my chops were not what they had been, you know. So then I had the surgery, and there's a little bit of a recovery period there, a few weeks. And so my surgery was, I believe, on February 19th in 2020. And about 3 weeks, I thought, okay, I'm starting to feel like my old self again. You know, now I can get out in the world and start doing stuff. And then March, 16th or 17th, something like that, the whole world shut down. And so I thought, oh, okay, well, I guess I'll be stuck at home for a while, for another few weeks, you know. It's been 6 months, what's another few weeks? I was one of those that thought, oh, well, you know, a few weeks, then we'll all go back to, our lives. But so at the outset of the pandemic, there was so much anxiety, and I thought, man, what can I do? There's not much I can do. And I thought, well, maybe I'll post a little video on Facebook, you know. And also, I'll play a different instrument every day for whatever, you know, a couple weeks until the world returns to normal, naively. And also I thought, well, this will be a way for me to kind of get my chops back up and, you know, so on. So anyway, so I started doing that, and then, so I did it for, I think for 40 days, every day I'd post a different video, a different instrument. So one day I might play waterphone, another day, whatever, you know, some other thing. But yeah, then I started thinking, okay, well, I'm kind of running out of instruments here. Maybe I'll start playing found objects, which is something I've done for a long time anyways. And yeah, those ones, those videos, you know, people really responded to, actually. So you mentioned, I did one where I had a set of canoe paddles that I played, and so it's essentially a kind of marimba-like instrument or a xylophone-like instrument with canoe paddles, but they're sonically kind of interesting because I sort of play up and down the shaft of the paddle. So I start out playing essentially the place where you would hold it, the handle of it, but then I play up and down the length of the shaft, and that creates a pretty interesting kind of timbral shift. And it actually sounds like I've played this in, you know, live on a number of occasions too, and every time somebody says, well, so what kind of effects pedal were you running that through? It really sounds like it's electronically processed, and it's just the acoustics of canoe paddles, the way I was playing them. So anyways, that one, you're right, that particular video, and then a few other ones got was shared quite, you know, several thousand times, and you know, was viewed quite widely. But the other thing that was nice about that was I heard from parents and also teachers, because music teachers were like, what on earth are we going to, how are we going to teach? I mean, Zoom and similar platforms hadn't, I mean, you know, people were doing stuff on them, but they, you know, there were still some bugs to be worked out there, particularly when it came to music, trying to do music online. So teachers just, you know, I think so many teachers, and music teachers in particular, were having a hard time. But they really responded to those videos in particular, and would, you know, so I heard from teachers all over the world who said, oh, that's great. You know, I've started doing some found object improvisation, getting kids to do found object improvisations in their own home, using whatever they have, you know, in their own home, going on almost like a kind of scavenger hunt and trying to find things that they can make sound with, make music with. So that was kind of nice too. And so through that, I actually heard from, as I say, many, many parents and teachers all over the world. You know, in some cases, they actually sent me videos of their students or their kids playing found objects, which was really, you know, lovely to see. So that ended up being a nice experience. So I think 40 of those videos, and then I thought, okay, I can't keep doing this every day. So then I did them weekly for a while, and now it's more sporadic. I still post videos from time to time, but I've also gotten busier in the 2 years since. So now, yeah, I mean, if I post a video a month of something, you know, that's about par for the course these days.
Mm-hmm. That must have been so gratifying to get that feedback about the kids. And I want to talk about your work, you know, as a community activist in inclusivity, but I was wondering if we could have, like, do you have your hand pan there maybe or something?
I don't have a hand pan, but I do have some other things here that I can show you. So I showed you the water phone, mm-hmm. But maybe because we've been talking about, you know, found object improvisation, or composition for that matter, mm-hmm. I can maybe talk a little bit about my approach in that area. And so I would say, you know, again, taking this idea as a starting point that, you know, any sound can be a viable musical resource. So when I find a sound, let's say, so I have two stones here. These are just stones that I've picked up on the shoreline of Lake Ontario. So we can tap them together, right? Okay, and we get a sound, and that's okay. But then, so I always think, well, what can I do with that sound? How can I vary it? You know, so thinking about sonic variation. And thinking about variation in different musical parameters. So an obvious one is rhythm, right? So instead of just a constant pulse, if we make play something maybe a little more syncopated, that's more interesting, okay? But it's still the same sound over and over again. So if I wanted to add a little timbral variation, how might I do that? Well, one way would be to use my mouth as a resonator. So thinking about resonance. So if I change the shape of my mouth, I'm going to sort of change the resonance of the stones. And so we'll get a little bit of timbral variation. Hopefully that'll translate here. I'll give it a try. you get the idea. So this is sort of, that's sort of my approach. That's really just kind of fueled by curiosity and just it's a process of experimentation and trying to find different sounds. I brought a steel mixing bowl took from our our kitchen. And there's lots of sounds. I actually use these all the time. I mean, if I just strike it, if I hold it like this, it has a nice kind of bell-like tone. So that's kind of nice. Well, and here I have, this is just a piece of steel electrical conduit. So if I, can you hear that? That's very quiet. Get lots of different sounds out of it, and I mean, if we add a little bit of water, this was my drinking water, but we can use it, put it to musical ends. We were talking about water earlier. Just pour a little bit of water in there. Maybe I'll put that away from the computer, and then if I use a mallet. Like the water phone earlier, you know. So that's sort of my approach, you know. Okay, that's an interesting sound. What can I do with it? Essentially, that's the driving question. Now another. I play regular instruments too, regular, more traditional, let's say, instruments. So I have a snare drum here, and I've just finished working. You know, you can't see that at all, can you? But if I do this. Maybe you'll see it. Okay, yes, there we go. You don't see me, but that's okay. You'll see the drum. So I've just been working on a set of 32 studies for solo snare drum, and some of which are for like prepared snare drum. So I these aren't really like traditional rhythmic studies. They're more about sonic exploration. So some of the things like these rubber ball mallets. You know, we can get all kinds of different sounds. This is a smaller rubber ball here. Right. You know, even just with my hands, or you know, I have drumsticks here, but you know, instead of playing it, you know, in a more traditional way, what if I do this? So I've been working on these 32 studies, which try to get as many different types of sounds out of the snare drum as possible. But if we sometimes I'll combine different things. So the snare drum with found objects. So I just put two shoelaces across the snare drum, and I have some wrenches here. This was a lovely discovery, a recent one at that. So I'll show you. What I do with these. Okay, so if I put the shoelaces on the snare drum and then I put these metal, just regular metal wrenches on there, the drum kind of amplifies and acts as a resonator for the sound of the wrenches. So I'll play them and you can hear. And of course I can still play the drum too. So that's sort of, it's a kind of a, in a way, it's almost a similar approach to the one I described earlier about a process of experimentation and then, you know, finding a sound and then thinking, okay, what can I do with this? How can I vary this? How can I work with this and hopefully sustain interest in this, you know, sound world that I'm working with here. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, is kind of like, you know, my approach to these sorts of things.
Wow, you know, I love that. And actually, the wrenches was really magical. That was very, very cool, the combination.
Oh, good, I'm glad.
So you've been involved in a lot of outreach in different formats for more accessibility in the community.
So I started an organization called We Are All Musicians, and the name of it sort of, you know, really summarizes the philosophy behind it, the idea that, you know, everybody is a musician, everybody, you know, should have opportunities to play music if they want it, but the reality is that not everybody has, had that experience and had opportunities to do so for a wide variety of reasons. To a considerable extent, music education in Canada, and I think this is true in a lot of other places, you know, has tended to be a function of class privilege. So that's one thing that I've, you know, been thinking about, and the We Are All Musicians Project is sort of, the intention is to make sure that everybody, including people who maybe, you know, whose parents didn't have the means to put them in piano lessons or violin lessons or whatever, making sure that they have opportunities to play music as well. Part of that work has also been around, playing music with people with disabilities of various kinds. And of course, there have been many wonderful musicians who have disabilities. In fact, some of the greatest musicians have had disabilities, I think of jazz guitarist Django Reinhardt, for example, who he was involved in a fire, and so his on his cording hand, he really only had the use of two fingers, and became one of the great, I would say universally acknowledged as one of the great jazz guitarists of all time, and so I think the traditional narrative was like, oh, isn't that amazing that he became such a great musician despite his disability? But I think maybe we need to reframe that and think, well, maybe it was because of that he played the way he played. You know, maybe we need to not think of it as, oh, wow, what a problem that he overcame. But maybe it actually led to him becoming that, incredible musician that he was. But at any rate, there are, there have been people historically who maybe maybe have limited motor control, for example, and can't hold or pick up traditional musical instruments, you know, that can't pick up a drumstick or hold a saxophone or a violin or something. And so now I think we have a real opportunity because, you know, there are all kinds of technologies, adaptive and assistive technologies that can be harnessed to make sure that everybody, including people with limited motor control, have opportunities to make music. And so that's some of what I've done, what I've been interested in and I've tried to do with We Are All Musicians, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so I know you have your cymbals, or what are those, gongs behind you?
Yeah, plate gongs, yeah.
Yeah, so they're, I talked briefly with, no, if people heard the episode with that, Ellen Waterman, we talked a little bit about Pauline Oliveros and the adaptive use musical instrument, which you were also very, but not everyone's heard that episode and they might not know what I'm talking about.
Sure. So yeah, I can give a very brief kind of description of that. So Pauline Oliveros was a wonderful composer and improviser and theorist and humanitarian and a dear friend of mine and Ellen's and someone I had the good fortune of playing music with on a number of occasions. And anyways, about, I'm going to say 15 years ago or something now, she had the idea. She said, you know what, we should try to come up with an instrument that can adapt to anybody's range of motion. So if someone can only move their eyelid or they can only move a few fingers, how can we make an instrument that they can use and they can play? And so that was the start of what became the Adaptive Use Musical Instrument, or AUMI, which is pronounced variously. I say AUMI. I think Ellen says OMI, but, you know, whatever. AUMI is the acronym. And basically, it's a kind of movement-to-music type technology. So you can use a built-in webcam on an iPad and track movement, even very small movement. So you can zoom in. I've used this in a variety of contexts for a while. I was, prior to the pandemic and prior to me getting sick, I was making music every week at St. Vincent Hospital in Ottawa, which is a complex care facility. And so, you know, many of the patients there have limited mobility. And so so there's a young woman who had a spinal injury who really could only move a couple fingers and her eyes. And we could track that movement. And she could play music, and she and I would bring a handpan or something, you know, a drum or whatever, and we would play music together and have fun. So that kind of thing. So it's been, the adaptive use musical instruments been used a lot in those kinds of settings, in therapeutic, you know, settings, hospital settings. But music therapists have used it, but you know, often I use it in community settings as well, And traditionally, the way most people use it, except for me, as far as I know, to date anyways, have used it to trigger digital samples. So it comes with all kinds of samples, and you can change the tuning, and you can change the sample, the type of digital instrument that it's that you're hearing. You can load your own samples. But what I have started doing with it, and this started when I was at St. Vincent Hospital, I would bring it in and I would set it up, and then, but I would, instead of triggering a digital sample, I would use the adaptive use musical instrument to send MIDI signals. MIDI stands for, what does it stand for? Musical interface, no. Musical instrument digital interface, yeah. And I would use it to send MIDI signals to little strikers, little mechanical strikers that I would build, and attach to acoustic percussion. So the person who could only move a couple of fingers or their eyes or whatever would track that, and they would move, and a cymbal would play, or a gong, or a cowbell, or a drum, or whatever, you know. And that was, I think, a little more exciting for people than, and it was maybe also, I think, a clearer sense of causality in a way, you know, like you do this and, you know, very quickly, I mean, it's almost instantaneous, you hear a sound. So anyway, so I was working on that, and then I got sick, and it got hard for me to move my equipment around. And then we were in the pandemic, and I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I'd really love to still be able to make music with people online. And so I started making these gongs. They're just made out of aluminum, so they're kind of plate gongs. And I made quite a few. This is only a small number. I made about 70 of them so far. And of different diameters, and also different, these ones are all circular, but I made some of that are in different shapes too, polygonal shapes. They have a different timbral quality actually. But anyways, so there I have some, I don't know how well you can see that, but I have a few strikers attached to the frames in which the gongs are mounted. And then what I do is I track movement over Zoom or the platform that we're on today, Riverside. I've never tried it with Riverside, but we could try it if you like, and just see if it works. And then that way, your movements could actually activate the gongs, and I could play Waterphone or something else, you know. But at any rate, what this does is it allows me to still play music with people actually all over the world. In next week, I think, or maybe in 2 weeks' time, I'll be playing music with some people in Malta. Mm-hmm. And this is, it's through an organization there called Opening Doors. that you know, helps people with intellectual disabilities. And so we're going to have a jam session through Zoom in a couple of weeks. But I've used this with people all over the place, so that's been kind of nice, actually, you know, to be able to do that. And so sometimes the people I'm playing music with have instruments. So for example, if you wanted to break out your fiddle, we could do something together. But they don't have to. So all they need to do is move. And if somebody, you know, maybe they have limited mobility, if they can, you know, position their hand very close to the webcam on their phone or whatever they're using, they can actually play the gongs, and then I can play other things. So that's sort of how that's been working. Do you want to give it a try, or?
Sure, Jesse. I'm happy to get out my fiddle, but it might be interesting if I can just try with my fingers. Yeah.
For sure.
So will it react to me moving?
Yeah.
Okay.
It should.
Do I need to go near my webcam, or?
You're good.
Yeah?
I would say slower and lateral back and forth movements will work good. Will work best.
So if I play my violin, that will be a type of movement it will be reacting to.
Exactly.
And then what are you going to play? Because some people are listening to the podcast and they won't see everything that's going on.
I'll play the water phone.
Okay.
And I'll back up so people can see the gongs a bit better.
So I'll use some what we call extended techniques on my violin, as well as some more traditional sounds for people.
Great.
Thank you.
Nice. Now, when I go and move to turn it off, it'll maybe start up again here. Oh, actually, no, we're okay. Oh. Nice. Nice playing with you again.
Yeah, it was fun.
Yeah, lovely.
So you have written a book with A.J. Hebel about teaching improv pedagogy.
Yes. Well. So we have we finished the manuscript, and it's with the publisher currently, and it's just gone out for peer or it's about to go out for peer review. The world of academic publishing is notoriously slow, but that's in the works. Yeah, and the tentative title is Jamming the Classroom, but it's really a book about the pedagogy of improvisation, teaching and learning improvisation.
Yeah. And not just music improvisation, but...
We focus primarily on music, yeah. Mm-hmm. But that's a good point, though, that, I mean, when we talk about improvisation, I mean, everybody improvises every day, you know. We're all improvisers. We're focusing primarily on music, yeah, in the context of that book.
And I realize it's an academic book, but what, in sort of lay people's terms, what kind of things do you write about?
Well, the way the book is structured is we kind of look at, we look at different sites and different ways in which we learn to improvise. So, and we kind of start with the individual improviser and then kind of get progressively, you know, larger in scope. So various forms of self-study and self-learning are important to, you know, the development of most improvising musicians. You know, we spend time working on our craft and listening to recordings, you know, these kinds of things. So we talk about, self-study, self-learning. But we also talk, then the next chapter kind of looks at various forms of mentorship and also co-learning, broadly construed, because, I mean, at some level, we learn really from every other musician we ever make music with. I mean, I learned from what we just did with the gongs, you know. We're always learning from one another every time we enter into a musical conversation. So that's the next chapter kind of focuses on that mentorship, but then also various forms of co-learning, learning from and with one another. And then we kind of keep expanding the circle out a bit. And so we have a chapter where we talk about, you know, the importance of music festivals and concert series. Both Ajay and I have a background in arts presentation. He founded the Guelph Jazz Festival. More recently, during the pandemic, actually, he founded an online music festival called IF, which stands for Improvisation Festival, and which has had two iterations thus far. And in a previous life, you know, I was the artistic director of a presenter and producer of new music it's in Waterloo. It's called Numis. So we talk about, you know, arts presentation, you know, going to festivals, you know, as an opportunity to learn and grow as musicians. And then we just talk about learning in community environments as well. So some of the things that we talked about earlier in some of the community, you know, community music work that I do through We Are All Musicians, mm-hmm. we have a chapter that kind of talks about that learning in community, learning with and from community. So that's sort of the structure of the book.
Mm-hmm. And he, what's his background? What kind of stuff does he do, Ajay?
Well, Ajay, he's an English professor, actually, mm-hmm. at the University of Guelph in the School of English and Theater Studies at the University of Guelph. He was also my PhD advisor. I did my doctorate in that program. In name, it's a School of English and Theater Studies, although it used to be called, it had a funny name, it was the School of Literature and Performance Studies in English, and the acronym was SLAPSE, which, you know, often elicited laughter, so they shortened it to School of English and Theater Studies, which I think was probably a good move, but really it was the performance studies part of it that was of greatest interest to me and most relevance to my doctoral research. But at any rate, he was my advisor, but we already knew each other, and we had already, I think, recorded an album together. He's also a musician. He's also an improvising pianist, and I've known Ajay a very long time, I think going on 30 years at this point, and are pretty close to it anyways. So we've worked together a lot in a variety of contexts, writing things together, playing music together, you know, working on arts as art, you know, working together in arts presentation, that kind of thing. His background, his academic appointment is, his primary appointment is in English and theater studies, but he was involved in actually recently starting what I believe is one of, if not the first, graduate program in improvisation studies. So they started a master's program and a PhD program at the University of Guelph in improvisation studies, and it was Ajay and a number of other people, Daniel Fishlin also, a number of other people are involved there. But he's one of these people whose interests and expertise, spans multiple disciplines and fields. And Ajay started a international institute called the International Institute for Critical Studies and Improvisation. That's sort of housed at the University of Guelph, but with, you know, research affiliates all over the place, including myself, including Ellen Waterman, people in other institutions as well. So in a way, I think Ajay and some of these other people, including Ellen, Daniel Fishlin, and many others, have in a way kind of laid the groundwork for the field of improvisation studies, which didn't really exist 20 years ago, 25 years ago. It's really a fairly recent thing, and I feel as though they have contributed very significantly to, as I say, kind of laying the groundwork for that interdisciplinary field of study.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, in season one, I spoke with the improvising cellist Peggy Lee. Do you know her or of her?
I do. I love Peggy's work. Yeah.
Yeah.
I think very, very highly of her playing. I don't think we've ever played together, but I love her playing.
Yeah, and she spoke about when she first started improvising. It was with dancers.
Hmm.
Like, which I found really interesting. Like this whole cross disciplinary, how you'd feed off the energy in a different way. It was really interesting to me.
That is interesting. I came to working with dancers rather late. It's really just over the past 7 years that I really started, playing quite a bit, working quite a bit with dancers. I just recently premiered a new piece for which I wrote the music, and that was with Propeller Dance, wonderful integrated dance company in Ottawa. It's a professional contemporary dance company that includes some dancers with disabilities and some without, and that's what they mean by integrated dance. That's the term they use. And anyways, I did a piece for them where I was playing a relatively new instrument to me, and a very interesting instrument at that, called the euphone, which is sometimes known, referred to as the crystal bachet. It consists of glass crystal rods that one plays with moistened fingertips. But it's quite interesting looking because it has these large sound diffusers, some of which are made of fiberglass, and then one is made of stainless steel, and they amplify and color the sound in a really interesting way. So anyways, I was playing that instrument with Propeller. We premiered that piece, I think, maybe 2 weeks ago. And then I'm also working right now with another dancer, wonderful dancer and choreographer named Natasha Bacht, who, in addition to being an incredible dancer and choreographer, is also a law professor at the University of Ottawa. Quite remarkable. So we've been working on a piece together as well. So, but that's relatively new for me. I hadn't really worked a lot with dancers, but I've learned a lot, through that process, and thinking about their gestural vocabularies and how, what kinds of sounds fit, and without always making it about kind of like me mimicking them. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's like a counterpoint, point and counterpoint situation. But that's been an interesting learning process for me, collaborating with dancers.
Is this composed music or partly improvised or all improvised?
I would say a lot of my work combines elements of composition and improvisation. So certainly there are some improvised elements, although through the rehearsal process, often what happens is the piece becomes a little more solidified so that the dancer, I mean, one thing I learned, I didn't know this before working with dancers, but dancers rehearse. I've never rehearsed for anything as much as I do when I work with dancers. Like, it's unbelievable. But the amount of time it takes to really internalize and get the choreography into their bodies, I didn't know that. And as a result, I think what starts out maybe a little bit more improvisatory often becomes less so through the rehearsal process, so that they can kind of count on musical landmarks that are going to line up in a somewhat predictable way with the choreography. But having said that, with Propeller, usually there are unexpected things that happen, and including in performance. And many of the dancers with Propeller are also exceptional improvisers. And so sometimes, yeah, something, that's never happened before will happen in the course of performance. And so I actually kind of like it when that happens most of the time, because then we enter into new territory. So I would say yes is the short answer to your question. It includes both. Is it improvised or is it composed? Yes, it's both of those things, and draws on elements of both.
Yeah.
That's true for the snare drum studies that I did actually develop scores for all of them, but many of the things that I asked the performer to do, there isn't really a way to notate them, so I had to develop a variety of different sort of notational strategies to communicate the ideas. So in some cases it's traditional Western notation, but in other cases it's like a set of written instructions. Mm-hmm. Augmented by diagrams and things like that. I just finished working on those snare drum pieces last week. So, yeah, I'm going to try to learn them myself and make audio and video recordings of them.
Great. Yeah.
Yeah.
And just to circle back to when you started as a jazz drummer when you were a teenager, I just love jazz, and I've been curious about this. So, jazz drummers, you don't really have to memorize the tunes the same way. You don't really need to know the chord progressions, or am I wrong?
Well, that's interesting. Need to, maybe not, but is it a good idea? Yeah, it's a very good idea. And in fact, typically when a jazz drummer, and the other thing is, when we say a jazz drummer, that can mean a lot of different things, mm-hmm. And even for me, it means something different now than it meant when I was, 20.
Yeah.
At that time, I was pretty narrowly focused on, for lack of a better term, bebop, subgenre of jazz and its derivative, so hard bop, modern jazz, essentially. That was really what I was focused on. Now I have, a much broader view of what constitutes jazz drumming than I did at that time. But at any rate... if we're playing, in a context like that, let's say, with a kind of hard bop band or something, it's really important for the drummer to know the tunes. So when they solo, it's important that you know the form of the tunes so that your solo reflects the form. And so that extends, part of that is knowing the melody of the tune, but also it's really helpful to know the chord progression. So when I was studying, when I was a teenager, my drum teacher would do something where he put on a blues recording, like a jazz recording, but of a tune that was based on 12-bar blues, and he would literally drop the needle, and he would say, "What measure are we in?" So I would have to I would only have a few seconds to know, okay, that's the turnaround, so we're in measure 10 or whatever. I would have to know, but he really drove this point home that we have to know where we are in the chord progression at all times, especially in a something like a blues form, 12-bar blues. That's essential. But, in other song forms as well, that's very helpful to have an understanding. So I would say do we always have to? Do we always need to know the chord progressions and harmonic form of the piece? Well, no, but it's a good idea. It's an important part of you know, I would say anyways, of playing jazz, particularly if we're playing, you know, tunes with chord changes. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's important that we know that. So studying piano is a very good idea, you know, for aspiring jazz drummers, I think. Having some grounding in jazz harmony is a very, very good idea.
But you hadn't studied piano when you were younger?
No, mostly self-study. I mean, that's not entirely true. I did take some piano lessons with a jazz piano player, and that was helpful. You know, that was helpful, yeah.
And just to close out, I'm curious, in your pre-pandemic life, were there trips you took where you had, like, amazing musical experiences? Is there anything that stands out to you, or maybe special performing experiences?
Oh, many. Many. Both, actually. Both as a listener and as a performer. Let's see. Well, what I could tell you about a few things that made a very deep impression on me. One was, it was in a lot of ways, it was kind of the first jazz concert I ever went to. I was, I think, 15, and I had kind of, I started playing drums fairly late. I think I was like 13 or 14, and I was mostly just, you know, I played in, you know, rock band, you know, with some friends and things like that. But I wasn't really taking it very seriously. But a friend of mine, his name's Dave Powell, wonderful saxophonist and pianist. He was a little more knowledgeable, especially along about jazz, than I was at that stage. And he said, look, there's a really famous jazz drummer coming to Toronto. His name's Elvin Jones. He played with John Coltrane. And I don't think I even really knew who John Coltrane was at that point. But he said, listen, you need to go and check this guy out. Let's go. So we went to hear Elvin Jones, and it was at a club, which is wonderful. At that time in Toronto, I grew up in a suburb of Toronto, but I didn't drive yet, so we took the GO train in, and we went to this little club on Bloor Street called the Bermuda Onion, which has been closed for probably over 20 years, I think, at this point. But at that time, they were bringing in all these incredible musicians to play there, so I heard Elvin Jones there. That was my first trip. But I heard Max Roach, another legend, you know, jazz drumming legend. Who else? Tony Williams, I heard. They're all incredible musicians. McCoy Tyner, who played piano with John Coltrane. I heard a lot of great music that really changed my life at that club. And what was really great about, you know, going to hear that music in a club setting was that I got to meet these people. I got to meet Max Roach and talk with them. I got to meet Elvin Jones, and who was incredibly nice to me and to my friend Dave. Very, very sweet. And so even before the music started, Elvin came over to us and was talking to us, and I didn't really know who he was, you know, but I thought, wow, this guy is so nice, you know. And then the music started, and it that was, you know, I've had many, you know, profound experiences, but that was perhaps the one that left the deepest impact on me, was hearing Elvin Jones play drums for the first time. And it wasn't just his, you know, chops or his musicality, you know, both of which were amazing, you know, but it was also, there was a kind of commitment to the music, to what he was doing, that left a very, very deep impression on me. It was really remarkable to see that and to hear that, and to then, you know, talk with him afterwards. And so that was one experience that left a very deep impression. And so I left that concert and I thought, okay, this is what I thought. I thought, okay, either I need to, you know, get my act together and really focus and you know, give this my all and really try to learn, you know, music, or I'm never playing again. There was no middle ground there. It was either one or the other for me. I thought, either that's what I learned from that. Elvin Jones put everything of himself into every single note that he played, and it was profoundly moving to me. And I just thought, that's what music asks of us. We we have to give it our all. And that doesn't mean that we're going to play like Elvin Jones, but we have to put all of ourselves into what we do, or else, you know, maybe music, maybe, you know, I will focus on art or whatever, something else, you know. So anyways, I thought, okay, I'm gonna really buckle down and try to, you know, put all of myself into music. So anyway, so that was one example among many of concerts that you know were really quite remarkable and left a deep impression on me. Now in terms of ones where I've been playing, I have many memorable experiences. I've had many memorable playing experiences. I play in a trio with a guitarist named Kevin Bright, who's an amazing guitarist, and a cellist named Matt Brubeck. And we have a lot of fun together. And so I have very, very fond memories of playing with those guys, you know, pre-pandemic, you know, a lot of very wonderful experiences. And what I remember most is the music, but also, you know, hanging out before and after and just laughing and you know, telling stories and having fun. We just laugh a lot when we're together, which is wonderful. And then the other person that comes to mind is David Mott. I mentioned David was one of my mentors, and I've played with David, you know, many times in many different contexts. I mean, we've played as a duo. We have multiple trios together, one with a New York bassist named William Parker, wonderful bassist and multi-instrumentalist William Parker. That group is called the Sonoluminescence Trio, and we've had some wonderful experiences together. But we play in other trios as well, and we, you know, I played in David's quintet and all kinds of things, and so I have many very, very fond memories of playing with him in a wide variety of contexts, including once he was invited to play for the Dalai Lama. The Dalai Lama was in Toronto, and David, much to my delight, asked me to play with him, and so that was quite an unusual gig, as it were, but it was certainly memorable. That's for sure. We were on stage, and we played right before His Holiness came on stage, yeah? And so there was a large... It was the opening of the Tibetan-Canadian Cultural Center in Toronto. And I can't quite remember what year that was. Probably maybe 2010, something like that. And there was a large sculpture of Buddha behind us. And there were Tibetan monks seated in lotus position on the stage, but like every square inch of the stage had, was occupied. So we had a very limited amount of space. So I had to be very economical. So I just brought a water phone, and David played baritone saxophone. I played water phone, but I remember being really concerned that I was going to, as I bowed, elbow the monk in the head, the monk who was seated right beside me. So that was quite memorable as well. But certainly I've had lots of memorable experiences with Stretch Orchestra, with Kevin and Matt, and also with David. But that's one that came to mind as particularly memorable.
Yeah, well, such a wonderful life in music already, and I'm sure many more great things to come.
Oh, well, that's kind of you. Thank you, Leah, and thank you for the invitation to speak with you today. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, super interesting. Thanks, Jesse.
My pleasure. Yeah, thanks so much.
If you enjoy this episode with Jesse, you will probably be interested in my conversations with cellist-improviser Peggy Lee and Ellen Waterman, a scholar who is an improvising flute player and vocalist. All episodes are available in video format and wherever you listen to podcasts. Please follow and share. If you consider rating this podcast, it will definitely help new listeners discover it.